Hello, I'm Anne Mossop, Sydney Writers Festival Artistic Director. We hope you enjoy this episode from our podcast program.
Wow, what an absolutely amazing sight. Hello, everyone. I'm just so excited. I've got to take my glasses off because I can't quite believe how far back you all go. Look, welcome to this session of the 2023 Sydney Writers Festival. First things first, my name is Cassie McCullough. I work for ABC Radio National, where, among other things, I co-host the weekly fiction review program, The Bookshelf, with my great friend and colleague, Kate Evans. If you haven't come across it, you can hear it at 10 a.m. on Saturdays on RN or whatever podcast platform you use. And you can look up our entire back catalogue. There's about 5.5 years of Kate and I nattering away with guests about all kinds of things and having the occasional disagreement.
That's the fun part.
That's what I think. Yeah. Of course, I would like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of this land, and pay my respects to elders past and present, and to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who may be here today. We're here, of course, to talk about The Bookbinder of Jericho and its companion novel, The Dictionary of Lost Words. I just want to do a quick show of hands. I'm going to put my glasses on here. Who here has read The Dictionary of Lost Words? Okay.
Beth Once or twice.
I bet. Who here has read The Bookbinder of Jericho?
Wow. Oh, thank you.
So maybe we do need to be a little careful of
spoilers.
Yeah. Who here is just absolutely envious and jealous of Pip Williams for her incredible overnight success? Of course, it's not overnight. It took years to get to write that first book, and then you just smashed it. Pip, hello.
Hello, Cassie. It's really, really lovely to be here. I was telling Cassie before, I'm a big fan, so we've done the fangirl thing, and now I can relax, and we can have a conversation like two adults.
Okay. Oh, God, I thought, Kate, I'm calling you Kate already. Thought we were already I was going to say, I thought you had better judgment than that, but anyway. Now, before we leave the incredible success part, congratulations, seriously, because the first book, The Dictionary of Lost Words, I did ask for these figures and they're the latest you can get. You ready for this? In Australia and New Zealand, the print sales have passed 270,000, and if with you count e-books and audiobooks, it's over 400,000, and worldwide, it's 500,000, half a million. Amazing. For a book that was launched in the middle of the you-know-what and where there were no events like this. So it was word of mouth and everyone told their friends about it because they had been moved and they loved it and they wanted other people to read it. Now, 6 weeks in, The Bookbinder of Jericho had sold a whopping 89,236 print copies, and every week since publication it has been number one in Australia. So that's 6 weeks in a row so far. So amazing. So what is it like now you meet people? What's the feeling like?
Well, I feel like first I should say thank you because none of those figures would be on your piece of paper without all the readers. So thank you very much. And what is it like? It's really different this time around. Like you said, the first book came out, I think it was 2 days after we all went into lockdown in March 2020. My publisher even suggested we delay publication, which is actually what happened with a lot of books, but I just, I'd waited long enough.
Yeah.
I said, no, what will be will be. And I think there was a bit of timing involved because it came out in the first week. Everyone was keen to do something on the Friday night. And so when I had a Zoom event in that first or second week of lockdown, 250 people turned up. They didn't know who I was. No one had read the book, but they were bored out of their brains. And I would have had maybe 20 people turn up to a library event. And so there was a little bit of serendipity around that. But the rest, the following 2 years was pretty quiet and I had time to write Bookbinder.
Yes, and let's talk about that because you already had it in your mind as you were writing The Dictionary of Lost Words. For those who are yet to catch up, although it does seem like everyone here has read the dictionary of lost words, that is, I'm sure there's a few people here who have read the dictionary as well. You probably have.
I've read some of it, yeah.
But this is set in a... There's sort of parallel universes in the one town. It's the same place. It's Oxford, University City, you know, much storied. But there's the distinction between town and gown. And where we are in the first is more gown. It's the content of the Oxford Dictionary. Here we are in the press itself. What's your capsule descriptor of where we go in Jericho?
Yeah, so as you said, the first book was really about a middle-class woman's experience, and the book Wonder of Jericho is all about the experience of working-class women, women who... The book is bounded by the years of World War I, and I was really interested in women who stayed home and worked and kept the country going, and who didn't necessarily have skin in the game when it came to World War I. I was also interested in the experience of people who flee war, and a lot of refugees came to Oxford at that time. But this story is about Peggy and her twin sister, who both work in the bindery of Oxford University Press, as what were called then bindery girls, despite the fact most of them were women. And the bindery was split in two, you see. There was the girls' side and the men's side, despite the fact that there were also boys on the men's side. And I was really interested in their experience during the years of the war. And Peggy is a really intelligent, curious, ambitious young woman. And every day when she comes to work, she looks across the road from Oxford University Press and sees Somerville Ladies' College, which was one of the first women's colleges of Oxford University, and she imagines herself in that place. But she has to turn from that place and walk in to what is much more of a factory setting and fold the pages of the books that she desires to read.
Yes, she's very quick-witted and intelligent and can see clearly that there's more to life than what she has. And she, even though she doesn't quite know how to express that or what she wants, you know, particularly, she knows it's more than what she has.
Yes.
So she's very good-looking, of course, and so naturally is her sister, who, because they're identical twins. Yeah. They live in a narrow boat or a canal boat. Do you want to just describe where they've come from and why they're there on their own?
So just before, 3 years before the book starts, Peggy and Maud's mother has died. Her name was Helen. And they grew up with their mother on a narrow boat called Calliope. And Calliope, for those who don't know, is the name of one of the muses of... She's the muse of poetry, I think, and storytelling. And apparently she was Homer's muse. And this is the name that Helen gave their narrow boat, which is where they live on the Oxford Canal. And it's full of books. And not just books, but sections of books, parts of books, books that have been rejected because they're not good enough, they're not bound well enough.
That's metaphor number one. All right.
there's so many metaphors that, I couldn't have asked for more metaphors just being in Oxford. So you were mentioning town and gown earlier. It's what's really interesting. So this is called the Bookbinder of Jericho. Jericho is actually a neighbourhood of Oxford, and that is the neighbourhood that Oxford University Press resides in. And Walton Street, which is the street that the press is on, actually divides Oxford and Jericho. And so literally when Peggy is looking at Somerville College, she's looking across the road from Jericho into Oxford. She is definitely town, someone who lives and works in Oxford. Gown are those people who are associated with the university, and they tend not to necessarily live in Oxford full time. And so, you know, just that divide, this story really is about this woman who simply wants to walk across the street.
Yes, parallel lives. Mm. And I think it's fair to say a lot of Oxford is still like that. It's
very much, it yeah. continues. Yeah, to I think anyone who's been to Oxford would, you'd notice that town and gown divide.
Mm, for sure. So their mother clearly was very intelligent, and she, you know, had these children. We don't really learn much about her partner, husband, dalliance. Mm. But this love of books is firmly cemented. Do you want to just read a little bit from the book?
Sure.
About that space that they inhabit? So this is Peggy and Maud, who we haven't really sort of touched on it yet, but look, Maud has a difference. You know, she's differently abled, so it's a world that she doesn't engage with the books, but Peggy does. Mm. Mm.
Calliope smelled a little sweet after having been shut up all day. A little earthy. The hatch swung closed behind me and I breathed it in. It's the smell of books, Ma used to tell people when they asked. It's the paper decomposing. They'd screw up their noses and Ma would laugh and say, I've come to love it. Ma had brought two books with her when she first moved on to Calliope, translations of the Odyssey and the Tragedies of Euripides, Volume 2. They'd belonged to her own mother and were worn from reading. Her collecting had only started after we were born. She picked up books at curiosity shops and fetes, and sometimes she brought them new, Everyman's Library editions for a shilling each. Most, though, were from the press. They were bound, but they had defects. Whenever I asked if she'd been given permission to bring one home, she'd never quite answer. It's waste, she'd say, not good enough to sell. Then she'd hand it to me, but good enough to read, don't you think? I always said yes, though when I was small, I could barely understand a word of them. Ma stored her books on a row of narrow shelving that ran between the windows, bow to stern. When those shelves were full, Oberon Rowntree built her another row. Soon after that, he built another. When we were 10 years old, he told her a fourth row of shelves could not be accommodated, so Ma bought a small bookcase from the brickbrack woman at the covered market. It had been dragged from the river at low tide and looked worthless, but Ma cleaned it, then sanded it, then oiled it. She placed it beside her armchair, just inside the hatch. Then she filled it with her favourite novels and all her Greek myths. Why do we have so many books? I like to ask. To expand your world, she would always say. When she died, my world shrank.
Mm. Yeah, that's beautiful.
Thank you. Mm.
And those who have read The Bookbinder of Jericho will probably be an alert to the Greek myths there, because there is a Greek tragedy of another kind ahead that we won't reveal. So we go into the bindery, and it's a really kind of pacey workplace. A bit of, I don't know, I think it would have been where you might find your future husband. but you've been lucky enough to find a footage of the bindery,
yeah.
of inside the press in the 20s, I think it is.
Yeah, early 1920s.
And you can see the women at work
yeah.
doing what they do. Describe mm. some of that, because so it is amazing.
It is. This is something, a bit of footage I came across when I was doing research for the dictionary, and it's actually something you can find on YouTube online. It goes for about 20 minutes, and I think it's called The Making of a Book at Oxford University Press. And most of it is about all of the processes that the men do, but because the women's work was part of making the making of a book, there were some segments where I can see what the women are doing. So there's one section where the women are folding all of the pages in the bindery where I've set Peggy and Maud's story. And the other bit of footage that really fascinated me is a woman walking along the gathering bench. So the gathering bench, once the pages are folded, they're folded into sections, and then those sections are gathered and into a text block. And this bit of footage shows a woman just, I think, dancing along this gathering bench. And it's the most beautiful video because she's really well-dressed.
Yes.
She's actually wearing heels.
High heels.
She's much like yours.
Hat.
And she's got a... It's just really lovely. But when I saw it, I was still writing dictionary, but the thing I first thought, immediately thought, was I wonder if she ever stops to read the words that she's just gathered onto her arm. And then I immediately thought, well, she couldn't, because this really is a factory setting. She has to go as fast as she possibly can, or production slows down. And really, that's when I first got the idea for the character of Peggy. Basically, this woman, I was thinking, yes, she would. If it was me, I would want to stop and read what I had just gathered into my arm, and what would that mean for my future?
Yes, and you'd collect the scraps or the things that were discarded, because they'd become so precious. But yes, that incredible metaphor of her being so close to these books, being so intimate, all the women, and having no real interaction with the content. And that was the tragedy, I suppose, of women's lives at that time. Although things are changing, the war is coming, and we know what happened to women's roles in the workplace during the war, but also the suffragette movement was gathering pace too. And I want to get to that, but let's just talk about Maud, because Maud works beside Peggy in this bindery.
Yeah.
And describe what... tell us about Maud, because you will put it much better than I will.
Well, I actually avoid labelling Maud in any way, but Maud experiences the world differently, and the world experiences her differently. And in her time, and by some of the people in this book, she might be described as simple, but she was anything but. She wasn't simple at all. She did have a form of communication, though, that was quite different, and today we would call that echolalia. So it's a way of communicating where you echo the words that other people have said, or phrases. Sometimes those echoes can be meaningless, and sometimes they hold quite a lot of meaning, but you do need to know how to translate the language in many ways. And so this is how Maud communicates. The people who love her and know her understand her. And Peggy, though, feels that she is responsible for Maud in many ways, particularly since her mother has died. And this is one of the things that holds her back. And I was really interested in exploring what it means to have responsibility for another person, because I think probably everybody here has an understanding of what it means to your own personal ambitions to have responsibility for a child or a sibling or a parent, and have to factor that responsibility into your decision-making about your own life and how you pursue your dreams. And so that was an interesting thing for me to explore in this story.
Yes, and Peggy's torn in ways, but there's also a loving community around both of them, and she's well understood, Maud, so that takes some of the pressure off Peggy. So enter the other world, and that comes in the form of a few people, in particular a woman called Gwen. And for the first time, the crack of the door into the academic world of Oxford opens for Peggy. But Gwen, I love Gwen.
Oh, good. I loved Gwen too. She's a guilty pleasure.
She can be really annoying.
Yeah.
But it's kind of great.
And yet you still love her.
Yeah. She's really gung-ho. Describe Gwen.
So we were talking about town and gown earlier. Well, Gwen is as gown as they come. So Gwen comes from enormous privilege, and she is actually a student at Somerville College. And prior to World War I really did change many things for women in general, but it also shifted the relationship between the working class and upper classes, or between town and gown. Because prior to the war, really the only time town and gown would interact would be in a master-servant relationship. But when the war started, women started volunteering in the many hospitals that popped up around Oxford. It became a hospital town, really, and a lot of the colleges, which had been, vacated because so many of the young men who were students in the colleges signed up to go to war. Mm. So only about 10% of the student population was there during World War I. So many of the colleges became hospitals, and women would volunteer to to read to the injured soldiers, to write letters for them, to roll bandages, to do whatever was required. And Peggy and Gwen meet doing this volunteer work. And it was one of those situations where they might never have met in ordinary times, but they are both called on in a way to do the same kind of work. And so they meet, and Gwen in a way takes Peggy under her wing.
They're a pet project.
A little bit, yeah, treats Peggy a little bit like a pet project, and is very keen to encourage Peggy to pursue her dreams of studying, essentially. But yes, she wears her privilege very lightly.
Yes.
She's fully aware of it and is non-apologetic.
She can have access to the books, to the college, etc. But actually she can't get a degree at that point either.
So, and she also can't access all the libraries. So the Bodleian Library is, the oldest library in Britain, and it houses every single book that's ever been published in the UK, even today.
Imaginably, that's a real storage problem.
Yeah, it is actually a real storage problem. But for a female student at Oxford to access the Bodleian, they had to be invited to be a reader at the Bodleian. And there were other libraries in Oxford that were particularly useful for studying for the exams and so on. And in those libraries, women weren't allowed at all. And so for female students to access some of the books that they needed, they had to be chaperoned by a male student. So they had to find ways of charming male students in order to get into the library, in order to study, in order to pass their exams and then not get a degree.
Yes. Mm.
Yeah.
Sounds really tedious, I've got to say.
Yeah.
So then there's another element to the story, which is obviously, as you've already touched on, the changing roles that women held, but also that war arrives in Oxford, and it arrives in Peggy and Maud's life as in the shape of two people. Mm. Tell us where they came from and why you chose to include them in this particular way, because they came from a place in Belgium which the details of that I did not know until I read your book, and it's particularly tragic.
Mm. So in September 1914, 200 Belgian refugees arrived in Oxford, and they arrived from various parts of Belgium, and they were fleeing the German invasion. And something that's, was quite poignant as I was writing this was Russia invading Ukraine. In much the same way, Belgium was neutral. Germany had, no right to invade Belgium, but they did. And so many of the Belgians fled to Europe, just as many Ukrainians fled to Europe. It was very easy to write this, really, much easier than it might have been, because I had the experience of refugees and those welcoming refugees on my television screen every night. And there was commentary about what was going on, which was not so different, actually, to the commentary that I'd been reading about in the library and the archives. Anyway, that's an aside, but it was really interesting. And two of these refugees that arrive in Oxford, one is Bastian, and he arrives on a stretcher, and Peggy meets him in hospital. He's one of the soldiers that she reads to. And the other is a woman called Lot, and she's a woman who has arrived on a train into Oxford station and been greeted by the refugee committee and by Peggy and Maud. And she becomes quite important in their life because she's given employment in the bindery at Oxford University Press, which is something that actually happened. So these refugees were often employed by local businesses in Oxford.
And she becomes significant as a carer as well. But tell us about your process, because you've been in libraries and reading these stories and piecing it together. You've been down a zillion rabbit holes, I'm sure. How do you how do you begin to build a novel when you've got all these ideas, all these forces? I mean, when you sit down Monday morning, you've had a break over the weekend. How do you do it?
First of all, I write every day of the week.
Oh, one.
No, but I should qualify that. I only write for between 2 minutes and maybe 3 or 4 hours. So, yeah, I think
it's, so what's the 2 minute mark? Is that where you're like,
well, that's because
I haven't got it today. Off I go.
Well, I have this, my process really is that I only have to write one word a day. So I figured I had very high expectations when I started writing books. My first book was a memoir, and I really hated the process of writing that book. And my expectations started at 1,500 words, 1,000, 750. I got down to 300, which was Virginia Woolf's word count, and I thought, well, if it's good enough for her. And that, not even that,
that
worked.
That didn't end well.
You know, so I decided what I needed to do. No, I didn't. We shouldn't laugh.
No, I shouldn't. That was totally inappropriate. Sorry, Virginia.
What happened was I decided my expectations were too high, and so I set myself a one-word goal and found that was very achievable. And in fact, I tended to overachieve because sometimes I'd write 10 words and sometimes I'd even write 300. And so I felt so good about myself because I thought, I'm nailing this. Anyway, so that's why I can write every day because
just
the expectation's so low.
I was talking to someone and said, I usually 6,000 a day is usually where I'm at. And I'm like... The concentration that you would need to, you know, string 6,000 words together.
I know.
So what's your biggest word count in a day, do you know?
Oh, it wouldn't be much more than 1,000.
Yeah.
No. And it's usually much more likely to be in the hundreds, but very often it's in the tens. So
yeah.
Yeah, and very often I will remove more words than I've actually added. So I don't know how to count that. I feel like that it should be. It's a formula. Someone could come up with a formula. But anyway, sorry,
this is
I didn't.
Very revealing. This is great. So I think every wannabe writer in the audience, and I'd say that's about 90% of the people here who are like, oh,
yeah,
okay,
jotting that down. One word
a day.
So in terms of the process of writing these books, though, what I tended to do was both of them. Really come from a curiosity, a question. So with the first book, I was curious about do words mean different things to men and women? And if they do, does it matter that it was a very male-dominated project? With the second book, I was interested in who gets to make knowledge, who gets to access it, because I was telling you, I've got this woman, it's like water everywhere but not a drop to drink. So she had, access to knowledge but she wasn't allowed to read it. Who gets to access knowledge and what happens when access to knowledge is denied? And that they were the questions that start the process. And then I do a little bit of, quite a bit of reading around the times and around the subject matter. And then I put that aside and I just fashion the story. And I am a planner in that I tend to know the whole story fairly quickly. I would kind of love to write from the beginning and not know what's going to happen, but I simply can't do that. My brain will take me to the end quite quickly. And in both books, I've written something near the beginning first, but the second scene I write has been the last scene in both cases. And those scenes have barely changed. So
you know where you're going.
I know where I'm going. And things can change along the way, and that's what the research sometimes does. So I sort of let the story dictate the research that's required, but sometimes that research will take me down interesting rabbit holes. And most of the time I have to be careful just not to go too far, because it doesn't serve the story. But every now and then it takes me to something that is just so interesting and so pertinent to the story that it helps to fashion the story slightly differently. So I really love the process. I feel like the process is continually feeding a curiosity rather than me just trying to fill in the gaps, you know, that I've created.
Do some bits call to you at different times? Do you go, oh, I've been putting that off, I've got to write that heartbreaking scene?
Or, yes, yeah.
I have time to do the romance today, I think. Yeah. Or, you know, like it's that...
It does, and I write out of order. So because I have a sense of where the whole story will go, it is possible for me to write scenes from right near the end one day and then come back to the beginning another, because I have a sense of how they're all going to fit together. Sometimes, though, by doing that, you know, I've written scenes that are near the end of the story and then something really interesting happens in the research while I'm writing something near the beginning, and it will have a knock-on effect. So I have to sort of change history a little bit. But, yeah, on the whole...
It's so meta. We're talking about how you've pieced together the content of a book, which is about how people piece together books, which is... You know,
so metaphor after metaphor after metaphor.
Yeah. So I mentioned that, yeah, the deep tragedy of the, well, obviously World War One, but also the Belgians who turn up, and what's happened to mean that they're in Britain. But the other tragedy that's happening is that day by day people are disappearing from the bindery, from the streets
from the
of
press.
Oxford. Mm. And actually in real life sentiment changed towards the Belgians,
yes,
after some time when the boys started to not come home.
That's right. They thought that the war would be over by Christmas. So it was declared on the 4th of August 1914, and a very early scene in the book, so this isn't a spoiler. And it's actually a scene in the... or it's a remembered scene in Dictionary of Lost Words as well, is 63 men lined up in the quad of Oxford University Press and marched out to war on the 5th of August. And these were men who had already signed up for the Territorial Army because they thought war was coming. Lots of young men. And so they lost 63 men in one day. But then there was this trickle of loss over the following months and years. And just like every other business in Oxford and in England, it was decimated. And this is where some of the opportunities arise, though, for women during World War One.
Yeah.
Women have to step into the jobs that men used to do, and, you know, lo and behold, they were quite capable of doing them. And, you know, this is one of the reasons women weren't given the vote, because there was all sorts of questions about how much they contributed to society and whether they could do some of the things that men did, whether they had the emotional and intellectual capacity to participate in that voting process. And so war changed things for women in many ways. On a day-to-day basis, they did different jobs. But by 1918, some women were given the vote. And largely that was thought to be...
Gwen got it.
Gwen got
didn't
it.
Didn't she?
Well, almost, yes. Yes, she wasn't quite of age, but yes, yes, she was entitled to vote as soon as she turned 30.
Yes.
Because she had property and a degree.
Yes.
But if you didn't have property or a degree, you weren't. You still weren't allowed to vote until 1928.
It's so easy to ask you questions and go down these rabbit holes with you, but one of the other tensions is that the suffragette movement was very, you know, gaining a lot of attention and was unique in its approach, very, very Me Too, I think, very modern in its way. But it was also part of the policy change towards getting men to sign up.
Mm.
They participated in the White Feather campaign, which features in the book as well.
Yeah, so a lot of people probably have an understanding of the White Feather campaign. It was a campaign actually devised by a parliamentarian, so by not by the suffragettes, but he enlisted the suffragettes, or the WSPU, Emmeline Pankhurst's group, to, I suppose, inspire institute it to make it happen. And so it was the suffragettes who would hand out white feathers to men who they thought were cowards, men who were not wearing uniform. And very often these men were sometimes home on leave and not wearing a uniform, and they would get a feather. Other times they were conscientious objectors, other times they were fearful, other times they were not of age. There were all sorts of reasons someone might choose not to enlist. Whatever it was, the White Feather Campaign was designed to encourage men to enlist, and it worked. But it was also part of a sort of deal, if you like, between the WSPU and the government to release women who were in prison, who had been imprisoned because of their activism, and for the suffragettes to step back on their activism and support the war instead. So not all of the... So many suffragist movements, many suffragist organisations did not agree with the war and did not support the war. And so it's interesting just doing the research. This is, I didn't know any of this before I started writing these books, but it is interesting to see the many pathways and the many organisations working towards the same goal in a way, but see how they do it differently. And where they come together and where they disagree.
And the dirty backroom dealing of politics as well, which gets whitewashed or swept away by time.
Yeah,
and you've brought it into this novel.
That's right. And the fact that women who, over 30, with property and or a degree, could vote in 1918 was supported by the WSPU.
Mm-hmm. There's lots of crossovers between these two books, which are quite rewarding for people who read both of them. I actually read these in the different order. So it's like, oh, this person...
Did it work?
Yeah, totally. My question is, what's the best response that you've had to this most recent one, I suppose? What's happened since it's been published? Because it's a short time and, must have had a... Yeah, a few things happen.
Yeah, oh look, being able to actually talk to readers has been lovely because I couldn't do that so much with Dictionary of Lost Words. So a lot of people who've enjoyed that book are talking to me now, and that's an incredible pleasure and privilege. But I've had lots of amazing reader feedback. But I'll tell you one story. I met a woman in Brisbane, and she has told me that I can share this story. And she had read Dictionary of Lost Words, and it had reminded her that she had a grandfather who'd worked at Oxford University Press, but she didn't really know very much about him. And when she came to me in the signing queue, she had a photograph of him, and he was in his military uniform, and he had worked in the bindery of Oxford University Press during World War I, and he had died in the war. And she told me that they'd gone back to Oxford and seen his name on the war memorial that is now in the press quad. And she wanted to thank me for kind of bringing her back to her grandfather, who she didn't know much about. And I just received a letter from her last week, having just finished The Bookbinder of Jericho, and she was writing to say she got to the end of the book, and at the end of the book there's just a photograph of signatures of people who'd worked in the bindery, and her grandfather's signature is in that photograph, and actually also I think a great aunt worked on the girls' side of the bindery, and her signature's there too. And it moved me incredibly, but the thing that's so moving, I know...
I'm wearing mascara, Pip, I can't.
The thing that's so moving is that I have woven fiction through the scaffold of history, if you like, and I hope I've told a truthful story in a small T way. And so to hear from readers who... I hear from a lot of readers whose grandmother worked as a bindery girl or whose father was in the printing trade. I've heard so many stories about people who've worked in this industry, and they're all from older people, about older people. And this is, it's not a dead occupation, but it is certainly on the way out.
Bookbinding, yeah.
Bookbinding, yeah, the old-fashioned way. So now it's done, there's probably some bookbinders in the audience. If you're a professional bookbinder, you're most likely to be a conservator, someone who repairs old books. But books are not bound the way they used to be. You won't see any stitching in the books that you buy from the bookshop today. And it's just really lovely to come across people who've had some contact or some family member has been in the
book trade. So did this woman know much about her grandfather?
No, she knew nothing about her grandfather before she read the book.
It's amazing.
Nothing. So all of this has come from reading the books and then trying to find out a little bit more about her grandfather. Yeah.
Wow, it's worth writing just for that one person. That is an amazing story. Would anyone like to be brave enough to be the first to ask Pip a question? Who have we got here? Hi.
Hi.
Come on down.
Yeah, thanks. Hi, my name's Lisa, and I love them. I'm a massive fan of all historical fiction. My question to you is, I think perhaps you might be able to answer this from a lot of writers. Food is something that's always incredibly important when we're creating social settings in books, and particularly when we're elevating a female character, as you have done in both these books, we often make her a bad cook. And I'm really curious as to why.
You know what?
Yeah, both Claire and Nichols.
Claire Nichols asked me this same question.
Right.
It was one of those questions I'd never been asked before. And I was, and she said, "Do you like cooking?" And I had to admit, I've lost interest in cooking.
Right.
And I have a feeling that I have just, if this is autobiographical, that's where it's autobiographical. I'm not really that interested anymore in cooking. But there is a good cook in this in this latest story. Lot is a wonderful cook.
But she's continental.
That's right. She uses garlic.
Yes. And she can do marvellous things with leeks and potatoes.
Yeah, that's right. I know. And leeks and potatoes were bountiful in England, but not very appetising.
Over here.
Hi, my name is Claudia, and I manage a book club for Hispanic women in Australia, and we are about to read one of your books. We waited to have the Spanish version as well, so that, you know, we could pick whatever language we wanted to read that. And also, I'm super excited because I have tickets to see the theater adaptation of Dictionary. So my question is, what is the process, or what are the benefits or the of having your books translated but also adapted to a different format to get different audiences, and if a bookbinder will have the same pass?
Oh, what a fantastic question.
Yeah,
it is $50 for you later on.
Did you plant that one? It's just been so satisfying to see the book translated into lots of languages, so more than 32, I think, now.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and actually a bit of a surprise. I'm talking about Dictionary now, a bit of a surprise because it's all about the English language and it's full of English words. And I was always curious about how different languages would translate that. But I think fundamentally what it is about is it's not just the English dictionary that might suffer from a gender bias. I think all dictionaries around the world have that same issue associated with them because of the people who have been compiling dictionaries have traditionally been men.
Yeah, and gender is probably just the beginning.
That's right. And I think it's
race
exactly. And it's wonderful having it translated to stage. And the way I feel about that, I was asked first, did I want to write the screenplay? I said no before the question.
Did you want to walk on roll?
No.
I would have said, yeah.
No, I'd say no to that. I'd probably have a trip on roll and that would just ruin everything. But I was asked first, did I want to write it? And I quickly said no, because I'm not a playwright. It's a very different form of art. But I have been involved in that. I have had coffee with the Verity Lawton, who's the playwright, and it's brilliant. And I've seen it workshopped and seen a read through, and it made me cry. And I know how it ends. So, I thought that was quite an achievement. But I'm very keen, and I think this always when I see books translated to stage or film, they're different art forms, and I'm really keen to see them do something different with the story. Someone I spoke to, because it's also been optioned for a mini-series, so when I was speaking to the producers about that, we were talking about, them having the same DNA, and I really liked that description of an adaptation, that it has to have the same DNA as the book. But I fully agree that the different medium needs to bring something to it.
That's
of its
so
own.
Generous. I think all the script writers and playwrights involved will tell you that that's unusual for a writer to be that generous. So good on you, I think.
Well,
yeah.
I haven't seen the outcome yet. So.
Oh, yeah.
You might want to sign anything, Pip.
Just record what I just said and they can play it back to me. Yeah.
Oh, that's so good. Look, at this point, we've got some wonderful questions coming in from around Australia. I'll just read one from Helen, who's joining us from Orange in New South Wales. I love how you tell stories about women. Do you have any Australian women stories you might explore in a book one day?
That's such an interesting question, possibly. But I did, I suppose, take a liberty with the Dictionary of Lost Words in that I included Muriel Matters in that story. And Muriel Matters was a woman from Adelaide, my hometown, and she actually was quite instrumental in the suffrage movement in the UK. And I really wanted to... Not many people here know about Muriel Matters, but she was a really significant figure.
Did someone say I do?
Yay! A really significant figure in the women's movement in the UK, and we should be rightly proud of her. And so the liberty I took was to weave her into the Dictionary of Lost Words so more people would know about her. She was the first woman to speak in British Parliament ever, and she chained herself to the grill, so the women were only allowed to view Parliament from a very high sort of balcony, and they had a grill in front of it so the men wouldn't be distracted by the women. And she chained herself to the grill and then gave a speech in Parliament. And it's the first woman to speak in Parliament. And that grill now resides in Adelaide.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Good on you, Muriel.
Yeah, go Muriel.
I reckon that person, we'll have to find out later on, but I'm sure you're a relative. Adelaide, yeah, right.
Yeah.
some great questions coming in, but let's go over here again. Oh, sorry, I didn't see you there as well. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Emily, and I really loved the Dictionary of Lost Words, mainly because I'd come back from the UK after being over there during the pandemic, and Oxford was the last place we visited before the lockdown, so... It was quite special. But I wanted to know, what was your favourite word in the Lost Dictionary? Because I like the morbs. That's my favourite.
Oh, morbs. Yeah, that's such a great question.
That's a good question.
And luckily, I have an answer for it, because that's the sort of question that could trip you up if you haven't got something prepared. But, okay, I have two favourite words which were in the dictionary. So you asked earlier, had I read the dictionary? And the answer is yes. And the first edition of the Oxford English Dictionary, the idea was to compile every word in the English language that had ever been and currently was. So they included words that were no longer in use, that were obsolete. And there were two that I came across that I want to resurrect. And the first is pastinacious.
Oh, yes.
And pastinacious means to have the character of a parsnip. I know, we all know someone with the character of a parsnip, don't we? So I think that should get more use. But my second truly favourite word is satisdiction, and that means having said enough. And I just think it's beautiful and has currency.
These words must not be lost at all. These are great. We're going to run out of time, so yes, let's have a question.
Thank you. Thank you for writing your books, Pip. They are absolutely stunning.
Thank you for reading them.
Oh, my pleasure. Really, my pleasure. I feel like a lot of authors, a lot of writers feel like they, whether intentionally or not, impart some of themselves into characters or into experiences in their books. And other than perhaps an interest or non-interest in cooking, I'm wondering if you find yourself in any of your characters in either or both of your books.
Which one do you think she is?
Yeah, guess.
Oh, I don't know. I'm too afraid to say. I'm too afraid to get it wrong.
neither of them are autobiographical, obviously, but there's a little bit of me in both Esme and Peggy,
yeah.
And both in terms of aspiration, I suppose. I suppose I'm very much like Peggy in that I have always aspired to learning and education, and I'm very much, I'm not as precocious perhaps as Esme. I'm dyslexic, so I didn't have Esme's facility with words necessarily as a four-year-old. and dictionaries for me were a love-hate relationship, which maybe is why I wrote about them to some extent, and why words fascinate me, because words have been a little bit more difficult initially. So I think only to that extent, but otherwise they are completely, you know, they are completely their own people. Yeah.
I'm Tilda, obviously.
Yeah, not Gwen. Yeah, we all want to be Tilda. I'd love to be Tilda, yeah, but yeah. I'm not a Tilda.
Yeah. I was once.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of all of all the things I've written about Tilda, and now are you blushing, Casper?
I just can't believe all these bookies got that joke. That's so great. one of the amazing things that happened when we were organising this conversation was the festival came back to us and said, this is going to be closed captioned. Could you give us a heads up on any unusual words that are going to come up in the conversation? And I was like, well, can we start with bindery?
Yeah.
Scriptorium? Pip came up with a really long list, but I don't think the parsnip word.
No, pastinacious.
Pastinacious.
Yeah.
Will have been there. Look, just finally, because we are out of time, I want to just prove to you that we are getting questions from across Australia. Oh, are they talking back to us? What are they saying?
Yeah, that's right.
That's so good. See, it's real. There's questions from all around Australia, but the one that I'll just finally ask you, it's from the State Library of Western Australia, and Sally and Carol are asking from there. Hi, Sally and Carol. Will there be a sequel? Will there be a third in these books? A trilogy is a nice word, isn't it?
I have an idea for another book set in Oxford. It wouldn't be a sequel or prequel again. It would be a companion, if you like. But it's a way off, so you have to be patient. And I might write something else in between. So they're very heavy on research, and I feel I'd quite like to do something that doesn't require quite so much time in the archives.
Just quietly, Pippi, if you're writing them one word a day... That might be your problem. Ladies and gentlemen, can you please thank me, Julie?
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and to rate our channel.